Our passage this evening comes from 1 Kings chapter 19 and verses 1 through 18. 1 Kings chapter 19, and we'll begin reading at verse 1. Remember, this comes on the heels of the giving of fire and then of rain on Mount Carmel. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and all about how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "May the gods do to me, and may they add all the more, if I do not by this time tomorrow make your life like the life of one of them." When he saw that, he got up and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. And he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom plant and asked to die and said, "It's too much. Now, Yahweh, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under a broom plant. And there was an angel touching him. And he said, "Get up, eat." Then he looked. Why, near his head, a cake baked on coals, and a jug of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. Then the angel of Yahweh came back a second time and touched him. And he said, "Get up, eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights all the way to the mountain of God, Horeb. And he came there to the cave and spent the night there. Ah, the word of Yahweh came to him. And he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been extremely jealous for Yahweh, God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant, your altars they've torn down, and your prophets they've killed with the sword. And I am left, I alone, and they're seeking my life to take it." And he said, "Go out and take your stand on the mountain before Yahweh." And indeed, Yahweh was passing by, and a great and strong wind was splitting mountains and shattering rocks before Yahweh. Yahweh was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. Yahweh was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, fire. Yahweh was not in the fire. And after the fire, a voice, a low whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the opening of the cave. And yes, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been extremely jealous for Yahweh, God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant, your altars they have torn down, and your prophets they have killed with the sword, and I am left, I alone, and they're seeking my life to take it." Then Yahweh said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and you shall go and shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram, and Jehu son of Nimshi you're to anoint as king over Israel, and Elisha son of Shaphath from Abel-Meholah you are to anoint as prophet in your place. And it shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will put to death, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will put to death. But I shall leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees of whom have not bowed down to Baal, and all whose lips have not kissed him." I don't like long introductions to sermons, so my apologies. There's something, though, about 1 Kings 19 that is just so fascinating and fascinates readers and expositors, and it's hard to pin down exactly what it is about 1 Kings 19. I suppose it's the sense of drama and so on. After 1 Kings 18 and Yahweh answering by fire and then answering by rain and so on, and now Elijah plunged into this despair in the face of Jezebel's retort, and there's just this whole, it's so dramatic and all of that. And it feeds your imagination, and I suppose, too, there's a sort of sense of relief sometimes that some of us feel, because somehow when someone seems to be so successful and carry the day, as Elijah seemed to do in 1 Kings 18, then when we get to the next chapter and we see him plunged into despair, we say, yes, he's made of clay too. And there's a certain gratification that our sinful soul seem to get perhaps out of that. Well, I suppose it's a mixed image, but I suppose I should lay my cards on the pulpit. So let me say that I think that most expositors and commentators that have dealt with 1 Kings 19 are wrong. I think that sounds arrogant. It's not really, but it sounds that way. I think they've gone in a wrong-headed direction. And so we have to deal with a little bit of those kinds of things. Let me give you a taste of the trend of exposition and so on. Now, I said this would be a longer introduction, and this won't take too long, but let me go through some excerpts from some expositors and commentators. Here's one from 1957. Elijah cracked up. As we read on, we see the man at whose courage all Israel had marveled, fleeing before the threat of a mere woman. Now, let's just stop right there just for a moment. There is no such thing as a mere woman. No matter how unprepossessed, etc., a woman may seem to be, she is a labyrinth, a kaleidoscope of mysteries. There is no such thing as a mere woman. The guy is wrong on that score. But you get the sense of what he's trying to convey. Another expositor say, oh yes, but Elijah now lost sight of the Lord and saw only a furious woman. He was now walking by sight. Another expositor who is an Old Testament professor and so on said, what a contrast! Elijah, the hero of faith on Carmel, victorious over Baalism. Elijah, the coward of unbelief at Horeb, self-occupied, utterly discouraged, wishing to die, praying against rather than for God's people. You might say, well, these were more popular expositions. What about the more scholarly folks, the ones who say they do close reading of texts and so on? Well, here's one who said that when Elijah said, I am left alone, it reveals once more Elijah's arrogance. And then another says that Elijah is transformed by Jezebel into a whimpering defeatist. And that God's question, what are you doing here, Elijah, implies that Elijah really ought not to be at Mount Horeb. That's the view. And then there's an Assyriologist who dons the white coat and analyzes Elijah by saying that he exhibited symptoms of manic depression, wishing for death, together with loss of appetite, not sure that's in the text, and inability to manage with excessive self-pity. And then, of course, there are others. Here's one in an evangelical commentary. It says that just when God needed him the most, the divinely trained prophet was to prove a notable failure. His God-given successes, chapter 18, had fostered an inordinate pride. I don't know how they know that, but it did. And then they talk about Elijah had come to bask in the glow of the spectacular. And then they say that God sent Elijah back to the northern kingdom, the, quote, place where he had veered off the track with God in his spiritual life. And there you have the usual, that's the usual kind of interpretation you get in 1 Kings 19. Now, why do we think that most this trend of exposition is wrongheaded? Well, there are certain things it doesn't pay attention to, and I don't have time to do this. We have to leave gobs of stuff out. But let me just touch on some things. One thing that nobody seems to touch on much is a matter of translation. In verse 3, it says, when he saw that, he got up and went for his life. But most of your translations don't read that way. They read, then he was afraid. And get up and now why is that difference? Well, because there are two Hebrew verbs. One is the verb to see and one is the verb to fear, and in this particular verb form that's used here, they look very much alike. What's in the traditional Hebrew text reads when he saw. But in some Hebrew manuscripts and some of the versions, it reads, then he was afraid. It's very difficult sometimes to tell that if they're very, very similar. But translators are so sure because he was afraid seems to fit right after Jezebel's threat. It seems to fit the story so well that they take that and then they run with it and they make Elijah into this panic-driven fellow to get away from Jezebel. As a matter of fact, it's not even sure that then he was afraid is even the right reading. Probably not. But you'll notice if you have the ESV, for example, they're so sure that that's the reading, they don't even tell you in a footnote that the traditional Hebrew text reads, and he saw that. Yeah, I don't need to go, I can't go into the technicalities here, but my own gut reaction to it is that probably when he saw that, which you have in the King James and the Old American Standard Version, is probably 70% chance of being the right reading. I won't explain why that's the case. But you say, well, but if that's the case, what's it mean when he saw that? What did he see? Well, back in verse 2, he saw that everything that had been done by Yahweh on Mount Carmel was not going to make any difference because Jezebel was still directing the religious policy of Israel and nothing was going to change. And when he saw that is, he saw that Jezebel not only wore the pantyhose but the pants in the kingdom. Nothing was going to change. And this drove him to that despair. So, just the way you take that verb can determine, I think, for some expositors, largely how they look at Elijah here. And there's a matter of geography. You notice that he gets up and he flees to Beersheba that belongs to Judah. You might say, well, he must have been afraid because he got up and he ran for his life, it says. Yes, he did. But it wasn't because he was afraid to die. He wanted to die. He asked Yahweh to take his life, verse 4. He wanted to die. He just didn't want Jezebel to do it. It would look like Jezebel had won the victory. So he just wanted to get away from her. But then he goes to Beersheba that belongs to Judah. He's in another kingdom, southern kingdom. He's in the very south of that kingdom. He's secure from Jezebel. No worries now. Then he goes a day's journey into the wilderness, 15 miles maybe, I don't know. And then after that, after the angel comes to him and supplies him with food, he goes all the way to about 200 miles further down to Mount Horeb or Sinai, probably in the Sinai Peninsula. If you think that Elijah's just panic-driven to get away from Jezebel, you can't explain the geography. Because he was secure when he got to Beersheba in Judah. So the fear, paranoia explanation doesn't really fit. So think of Jezreel, where Jezebel was, as Statesville, North Carolina. And let's say Elijah flees then from Statesville. He flees to Columbia, in our fair city. He would be safe here. It's a different jurisdiction, different state. Nikki Haley would never extradite him back into North Carolina. But then he goes down a day's journey, goes down to Orangeburg the next, and then he goes clear down to Savannah. If he's just trying to get away from Jezebel, what on earth is he doing going clear down to Savannah? It doesn't make sense. He had something else in mind. So the geography, and that brings up that locale in verse 8, Horeb, the Sinai, and so on, the Covenant Mountain. Why did Elijah go to the Covenant Mountain? Well, you notice that there was another place in Exodus 32 to 34 where Moses was on the Covenant Mountain doing covenant business and interceding for Israel, asking him to restore Israel to fellowship with himself, and so on. And so apparently Elijah is going to have covenant business at the Covenant Mountain, but he went all the way down to Savannah or to Sinai. Not because he's still running from Jezebel, but because he has covenant business. There's a reason for him being there. And then, of course, there's another matter. Verse 7, he always ought to listen to angels. The angel comes to him and says, get up and eat. And he looks, and there's that jug of water and that cake that was baked on coals. And then he does it again, and so on. Things happen in twos here. And notice what he said. Get up and eat. Otherwise, the journey will be too much for you. Now, one of the things that many expositors berate Elijah for is running all the way to Horeb. And look at Yahweh's question, what are you doing here, Elijah? See, he shouldn't have been there. The Lord rebuked him for even coming there. That's their take on it. Wait a minute. The angel suggested or nudged Elijah in that direction. Eat, otherwise the journey will be too great for you. The angel, God's emissary, the angel is suggesting, at least they're anticipating, that Elijah needs to keep going. So the visit to Horeb was a God-ordained thing, so that when he asked Elijah that question, what are you doing here, Elijah? It's not likely that it's a rebuke. Who could imagine that there might be another option? You'd never get that idea by reading most expositions. And then, of course, you need to always follow the context. You need to pay attention to verses 15 to 18. Because you see, what happens there after the Lord interrogates Elijah and Elijah gives him his answer, you notice in verses 15 to 18, Yahweh sends Elijah back. He's not just saying, as many think, you need to get back to work. No. He's sending him back, and he says, I want you to set apart three people, Hatziel, Jehu, and Elisha. And you notice in verse 17 what function they will have. They will be instruments of Yahweh's judgment on his people Israel. He says, the one who escapes the sword of Hatziel, Jehu will slay or put to death. The one who escapes from Jehu's sword, Elisha shall put to death. Now, that's not necessarily literal language, etc., but you see the image there. These three personnel are going to function as Yahweh's instruments of judgment upon Israel for their unfaithfulness. That's exactly what Elijah accused Israel of in verses 12 to 14, or 14 anyway. And so when you get to verses 15 to 18, and if you understand what Yahweh's saying, he's saying essentially this: you're right, Elijah. I agree with you. And judgment is going to begin at the house of God. And I want you to go back and to set apart the instruments of judgment through which and through whom I will begin to bring judgment on my unfaithful people, Israel. You're exactly right. Nobody seems to pick that up. But Yahweh essentially agrees with Elijah's assessment. So, what do you have here? Elijah, then, here is not some whimpering, panic-ridden, former excuse for a prophet, drawn up in a fetal position and whining because all Israel did not fall at his feet. He is not full of self-pity because of his spiritual arrogance had been punctured. But what do we have here? You have in 1 Kings 19 a broken servant, as Ronald Allen has said. who simply despairs over the cause of God in this world and thinks it is fruitless to go on. Well, in our comfortable pew cushions and semi-comfortable pulpit, it's easy to say, well, Elijah shouldn't have been thinking that way either. No, but it's a completely different thing than the way he's usually portrayed. And what if you become a broken servant and you think it's fruitless to go on? What do you have then? What can you have? What ought you to have? And I want you to consider that tonight as we get out of this contorted introduction. Well, you have or should have a healthy realism. That's first of all, a healthy realism. Verses 1 to 3. Ahab told Jezebel all Elijah had done and how he had taken care of the Baal prophets. Now, you can imagine all that he would told her as she says, "Why, Jezzy, honey, you must understand, the fire came down. When he prayed to Yahweh, the fire came down, and it wiped out all the sacrifice and the wood, and even sucked up the water in the trench, and then the rain came. That's why I'm dripping wet here." And, of course, Jezebel was at her night table getting herself ready for bed. And she flicked a little stray piece of mascara off of her eyelash and then turned with that derisive glare that she sometimes used on Ahab and curled her Revlon-treated lips and said, "So?" In other words, what Yahweh had done through Elijah wasn't going to make any difference. Things were going to go on as they were if she had anything to say about it. It's the education fallacy we often fall into. If we just get the facts before people, if they just have the evidence, then they'll get the point. They'll see the light. It'll be okay. No, it won't. It doesn't mean you shouldn't get the evidence before people. But unless God grants light to see what that evidence means, nothing's going to change. You need to get a healthy dose of the doctrine of total depravity and realize that it doesn't just deal with people's morality, but it deals with the state of their mind as well and the perversity of that mind. I can look at clear evidence and it will make no difference. John Blanchard, in his book, Is God Past His Sell-By Date, tells of George Wald, W-A-L-D. He was the winner of the 1967 Nobel Prize for Physiology. And George Wald wrote at one point, "When it comes to the origin of life on Earth, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago, but that leads us to only one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. We cannot accept that. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. Doesn't matter what the data lead one to, you don't necessarily accept the data. Need a healthy realism. God can show himself real. God can give all the evidence. Oh no, this is the verdict, that light has come into the world and men loved darkness rather than light. You need a healthy realism. Secondly, you have here a tender listener. You notice verses 9 and 13. You remember that we tried to argue a few moments ago that when Yahweh said to Elijah at Mount Horeb, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Now, he does that twice. I don't think that's a problem at all. The first time is a sort of a preliminary hearing. And Elijah gives the answer in verse 10. And then after the explosions of creation and so on, in verses 11 and following, and then you have a a low whisper, and Elijah knows that's the cue that Yahweh is there. You come out for what you might call the more formal charges. And he asks them again, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And then Elijah answers the and places it in the more formal situation. But what is this? We just said, if you understand that Yahweh, through the angel, had suggested and led and nudged and urged almost Elijah to go to Horeb, then when he asks Elijah, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" That's not likely it's a rebuke. That's not likely that's a reproof. What other option is there? Somehow nobody ever considers that it's an invitation. "What are you doing here, Elijah? To this servant who has been driven to despair over the cause of God in his kingdom." And he gives him an invitation to pour out the concerns of his soul and to unburden the trouble that was crushing him. Here at last, he can put it all out in front of Yahweh. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It's as if there's a tenderness that God seems to have. Maybe, is it putting it too extremely to say, there may be a tenderness that God seems to have, especially to reserve for his servants in their despondency. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Yahweh's servants always seem to know that they have that privilege, don't they? Remember Hannah, 1 Samuel 1. Eli accuses her of being drunk because she's praying, moving her lips, but not making any sound. And she says, "No, I'm not drunk, Eli." I'm paraphrasing. She said, "I'm a woman with a fierce spirit, but I have been pouring out my soul before Yahweh. I can dump my sorrow and my frustration and my grief in his lap." Or, as Psalm 142 says, "I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him." You have a tender listener. I remember I told you maybe a year or two ago, a time when I was in eighth grade. We were on a trip. We were out in Colorado on a vacation in the month of October, and I had gotten to get out of school for it. But I was sick on this particular day. We were driving along, I think in Denver somewhere, and my dad was driving, my mom was sitting in the middle, and I was in the shotgun seat, and I was looking out the window. I was sick. I had a high fever. I had kind of flu-ish conditions and so on. And I was looking out the window, and I saw something, and I asked my father about it. And he didn't know the answer, and he replied, "Oh, I don't know, son." He never, hardly ever called me that. But there was something about the way he said it, and I've never forgotten it. "I don't know, son." He knew I wasn't feeling well. He knew I was ill. He knew I was feeling cruddy. And it was just that, not a mushy kind of thing, but a masculine kind of tenderness. "I don't know, son." As if he reserved that for a time when maybe it was most needed. And I wonder if you have that when you're in despair and you are nonplussed and you don't know which way to turn. And I wonder if Yahweh perhaps meets you and says, "What are you doing here, Jane? What are you doing here, Randy? What are you doing here, Sarah? Kimberly? George? Floyd? What are you doing here, Matt?" You have a tender listener. You can pour out your heart before him when you're a broken servant. Thirdly, notice that you may have a holy despondency, a holy despondency. Here we pick up verses 10 and 14 in Elijah's answer that he gives to Yahweh. And I think we need to do something that many expositors don't do. We need to really listen to what Elijah says in verses 10 and 14. Pick up 14, for example. He gives his answer, "I've been extremely jealous for Yahweh, God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant, your altars they've torn down, and your prophets they've killed with the sword, and I am left, I alone, and they're seeking my life to take it." And how often interpreters will fasten on to the last two lines. There he is! He's whining in his self-pity. I'm the only one left. And he forgets about those 100 prophets that Obadiah said he preserved and so on. He thinks he's the only one and he has symptoms of this or that. Do you notice that when he brings the evidence, he mentions three problems? And the last is the fact that Israel is killing Yahweh's prophets, and he only brings in his own case as collateral supporting evidence. It's not like that's front and center. That's just, and also, it even involves me. You say, but he says, I am left, I alone. Well, he said that in chapter 18 on Mount Carmel, and nobody hopped on his case there. Is this really true? Is he exaggerating? Is he? No, I don't think so. In one sense, it's really true. Yes, there were 100 other prophets that Obadiah apparently preserved, but they weren't on the front line, out front, in public, opposing Jezebel and Ahab. He's the only one left as far as one who is out there, you might say, in the public square and openly opposing the Baal worship. He doesn't mean that there aren't other prophets, etc., of Yahweh. But he seems to be the only one out on the firing line. That's all I think you need to assume there. But the thing I want you to see is, look at where the emphasis is. Been extremely jealous for Yahweh, God of hosts. The sons of Israel have abandoned your covenant, your altars they've torn down, your prophets they've killed with the sword. That is, they don't want a relationship with you. They've abandoned your covenant. They don't want your worship. They tear down your altars. They don't want your word. They kill the prophets with the sword. What concerns him? There's a covenant people who are walking away from the covenant God. He's upset and depressed and despondent over the infidelity of the professing church. Do you ever get upset for something like that?
Oh, I don't too much, I'm afraid. I get despondent over puny stuff about my own life that doesn't really matter a hoot. But how often do I get upset?
For God's sake! And over God's cause, and over the fact that there's a faithless church and a persecuting church. How often does my despondency take that in? Yeah.
Yep. I think Elijah's concern and his despair and despondency should he have been that despondent? Well, technically, no, if he really realized he had Yahweh as his God. But there's a sense in which his despondency is a holy despondency because it concerns not his own matters and his own affairs, but God's cause. What is it that you get despondent about? Did you ever get despondent about those big things at the beginning of the Lord's Prayer? That God's name be hallowed means hallowed throughout the earth, as Ezekiel 36 says. And when that takes place, his kingdom will come. Do I get concerned about that? Then what's that mean? Well, when his kingdom comes, his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's kind of fodder, is that what I get upset and concerned about? Do I have a holy despondency if I'm a broken servant? Well, we must rush on. As in the immortal words of Dr. Thomas, the clock is against me. So I want to press one more matter upon you, a fourth matter. You have here a stubborn God, a stubborn God. Verses 15 to 18. Now you have a ray of hope here, and even though verses 15 to 17, the Lord announces the instruments of judgment that he wants Elijah to set apart, still he adds something more in verse 18. But I shall leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees of whom have not bowed down to Baal, and all whose lips have not kissed him. I'm going to have a people, nevertheless. This is what we sometimes call the remnant doctrine. I will have a faithful people. I'm going to see that I have a people for my own, even in the midst of this apostasy in Israel, Elijah. I will preserve a people for myself, in spite of the pressures of Jezebel's regime. It's interesting the way God always does that, isn't it? I was reading just the last several days, again, of Daniel Adams. Daniel Adams was a lieutenant colonel in the 1st Louisiana Regulars in the war between the states. And they went and fought in the Battle of Shiloh in 1862. And while they were fighting, the commanding general of the 1st Louisiana was mortally wounded, and so command fell to Daniel Adams. They were in this very thick battle called named after the Hornet's Nest, as they were fighting the Yankees and so on, and a musket ball hit Daniel Adams, went in right above his left eye, and exited right behind his left ear. Well, he was not senseless, and so on. They got him, I think, to a field hospital. That was just about as dangerous as being in the battle. And so on. And then they were transporting some of these men on a wagon back to Corinth, Mississippi. And so Daniel Adams' body was piled on this cart, and the teamster was taking it back. The roads were muddy and so on. It was hard with a heavy load. And so the fellow looked back, and he looked at those that didn't seem to have any signs of life, and so he threw Daniel Adams' body off to the side of the road, along maybe with some others, to lighten his load so he could get on to Corinth. Well, it so happened that some fellows from the 10th Mississippi came by, and they happened to see Daniel Adams there, and they happened to notice just trifle signs of life. And so they got him to a hospital, and believe it or not, the guy recovered. And they promoted him to brigadier general. And 4 months after his wounding at Shiloh, Daniel Adams was pronounced fit for duty. The guy had two holes in his head, for crying out loud. But it's like he was impervious to destruction. That's the way it is with God's remnant. Not because there's something special about the remnant, but because God makes them that way. God's true people are impervious to destruction. Just ask North Korea. They've never been able to eliminate them, have they? And so on. That's what you see here in verse 18. And that's what the Westminster Confession of Faith is so helpful about in chapter 25, which I hope sometime you will read. You know, it does the usual changes on the church, what anybody might say about the church. You know, everybody has complaints about churches, blah, 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 and so on. And Westminster Confession acknowledges that. You know, they say, the purest churches under heaven are subject both to mixture and error. You know, you got a whole range of problems there and so on. And you have anything from soup to nuts and not a few nuts and so on. So they're acknowledging there are problems with the churches, etc. And then they say some
have so degenerated as to become no churches of Christ, but synagogues of Satan. Some churches can peel away so much from sound doctrine and living, etc. The church is an unchurch. It's no longer church. Then you have this one-liner, nevertheless, there shall be always a church on earth to worship God according to his will. That's what you have in verse 18. But I shall leave 7,000 in Israel. None of their knees have bowed to Baal, and none of their lips have slobbered on his image. I will keep my people. He's decided that he will have a true people, that he will have them and keep them. And there's nothing any Jezebel can do to stop it. Now I suggest I can't make this a real warm and cuddly application, but I suggest that if this infectious assurance oozes its way into your spiritual guts, it will drop an anchor in the basement of your soul, because you have, even in your despair, a stubborn God who insists on keeping a faithful people for himself. So, you don't need to fear being a broken servant when you have such a compassionate and adequate God. Let us pray. We offer our thanksgiving to you, our God, once again at the close of an exposition of the Word, because you know how to care for broken servants, and we thank you for that. And we thank you, O Lord, that you know how to preserve also a beleaguered and suffering people. And so we offer up our thanks to you in the midst of our quandaries, for being such a faithful and stubborn God. Amen.